Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. Today, I'm joined by Ryan Sean Adams and David Hoffman from Bankless. They run a YouTube channel, a podcast, and a newsletter. They're big proponents for Ethereum, and I'm honored and privileged to welcome them on my show. Welcome, Ryan and David. How are you doing?
It's great to be here. Thanks, Dave. Good to be with you.
Thanks, Dave. This is going to be a ton of fun.
Awesome. Yeah, I can't wait. I've been wanting to interview you guys for quite a long time. I had a James Wang, a former ARK analyst, on, and he just raved about you guys. He really felt like you guys could articulate the Ethereum bull case in a super clear way. And so I want to focus this discussion on helping people understand the Ethereum bull case. And I want to really make it an impactful time where you guys can really dive into kind of from a fundamental level, like exactly like what is Ethereum? Why is it so different? And why do you guys have so much confidence in Ethereum, let's say 5-10 years down the road? And what kind of gives you that kind of, you know, lasting confidence? But before we dive into that, which will be the bulk of this, I kind of want to start out and say, like, ask you guys, what were you guys doing before you guys started Bankless? What were your day jobs and background there?
Do you want to start on that, David?
You started the Bankless newsletter first, so I think we should go in order of chronological order.
I guess, you know, my story is kind of I was an entrepreneur, healthcare technology startups, that sort of thing, and then sold our company in 2013, and I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do next, and then close to the one we're at, where you get some spare time on your hands. So you get to research some things. And so I went down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, like, hard. This was in 2014. And I was getting this thing. It's called the cluster headaches. It was like very painful form of headache, right? Some people call these like suicide headaches, okay? Because like very painful headaches. Anyways, on some medication at the time for this. This is like a prednisone. And I was coming off that medication, and a side effect of coming off the medication too quickly is you actually can get into like a manic kind of phase. Okay. So like I'd never had this, like I'd not done a lot of experimentation with drugs or whatever, but anyway, I was in this manic phase where I literally did not sleep for like 4 days, Thanksgiving weekend. I spent all of that time researching Bitcoin and crypto. So like every Andreas Antonopoulos thing I could get my hands on, decided by the time Monday came around that I wanted to quit my job and go full time. Anyway, the drugs wore off. I decided to keep my job and stay in the corporate world for a bit longer. But I had been fully, I guess, red-pilled into Bitcoin at that time. I was just like, what else can you do with Bitcoin besides hold it? It's kind of my question, right? So like there wasn't a lot of interest besides getting price exposure to the asset that I had until Ethereum came around. And what I saw in Ethereum was like something broader, which is like, all of the other things that you can do, all of the money verbs that you can accomplish that could actually replace the banking system as we know it. So if you believe in sort of the Bitcoin thesis, it's all about a more sound money. Let's replace central banking with this, you know, credibly neutral monetary policy of 21 million fixed cap, right? It's like a money system, a money standard. But like then you have to rely on all of the crypto banks to do everything else. So if you want to borrow money or lend money, you got a BlockFi involved. If you want to transact Bitcoin for another asset, well, you have to use like a Coinbase exchange, right? So there's all of these banking intermediaries. And that just felt like kind of a dead end to me, because I knew what would inevitably happen is the same thing that happened with gold, where the bankers would capture it and they would like relegate Bitcoin to this thing on the side. And it would never actually replace fiat and replace the banking system as we know. But I saw that potential in Ethereum, okay? Because Ethereum is not just a monetary layer, it's a banking system on top of that. And that's what DeFi is as well. And at the time, like, so I got into Ethereum 2016, 2017. And at the time, this was after like the crash in 2018. People didn't believe in DeFi at all, okay? The narrative is not what it is right now. People like didn't even think it was a thing. Ethereum was dead at the time. Bitcoin was maybe would see resurgence, but it was the only crypto asset. There was Bitcoin maximalism that was pervasive. And in that backdrop, I decided to start Bankless as a newsletter, because I just I saw so much more. Okay. My first Bitcoin transaction sending Bitcoin was like a magic experience. The first time I opened a collateral debt position on Maker was a magic experience. All right. It's like the ability to take out a loan without a bank. I mean, I'd taken out mortgages before and you talk to a broker, you fill out, how much paperwork, there's like origination costs. I could, with a simple transaction on Ethereum, get a collateral backed loan. Okay. This is like incredible to me. And so I knew there was so much more happening in DeFi and the story wasn't getting told. And Bankless has really started as a way to bring others on the journey and also to explore my journey. That's really where I met David, because like David was writing some of the same things. He was actually writing at Maker at the time. And so he and I, it's a funny story, we've never met in real life. Okay. We've had the podcast. I don't know how many hours I've spent with this man over here, but like we've never met in real life. Okay. And, but like, we were both on the same journey. And so David said, you know what, Ryan, you got a newsletter. We should start a podcast too. And David had written a lot for the newsletter at that time. So he sucked me down the podcast rabbit hole. And then we have the podcast and the newsletter and the YouTube. And all of this is an exploration of what we call the bankless journey, which goes beyond just holding Bitcoin as an asset. It includes that. And then it goes into all of the things we can actually do in the crypto economy, all of the other money verbs, the lending, the borrowing, the trading, the derivatives, all of these things that we can do without a bank. That's why it's called bankless. And so David and I have been on that journey ever since last 2 years. So yeah, David, why don't you tell us your story too?
It's actually crazy. You guys haven't met in person just because you guys seem like you guys have such good chemistry on your podcasts and your videos, and like it feels like you guys have been friends forever. it's awesome.
I feel that way too, but
it just goes to show that like the whole in real life world is actually not necessary to really establish friendships and relationships, and like there's no coincidence that Bankless really got started in the middle of COVID. Our second podcast was during that March crash that really just like wiped the floor out of every financial markets, and then it was COVID from then on out. While everyone has their own unique like backstory of how they got into crypto, I think Ryan's is like the most crazy, because like how many times does like a manic withdrawal from drugs actually like get you to actually go down the Bitcoin rabbit hole? Like that's the most unique like instigation of crypto I've ever seen.
Kind of weird, man. I don't know. I should try it again and see what other discoveries I make. But like, I don't want to go back to cluster headaches, dude.
Right.
Awesome. Want to hear your background? What were you doing before Bankless? Yeah, and how you got interested?
Yeah, totally. So what I was doing before Bankless, graduated with a degree in psychology. Really thought like psychology was a very positive psychology, whereas most of psychology is dealing with sick people. Positive psychology is like, well, psychology is a domain of knowledge. How can we help normal people feel better about themselves? And like the idea I had is that it's the easiest, lowest cost effort to make the maximum results for the greatest good, right? Like if everyone around the world, everyone has a brain, everyone's related to psychology, everyone can relate to positive psychology and become a better person that way. But then I was also very much interested in physical movement, because how can you actually feel good without moving your body? Like you need exercise to feel good, but then also nutrition. And so all three of these things, I was like, well, if we want to make everyone in the world feel better, like we need to tackle tackle psychology, tackle nutrition, tackle physical movement. And I thought that there was a niche that I could carve out there. The problem was that is three different like trajectories of education, a bunch of debt. And I thought like maybe physical therapy, where I can get a doctorate in physical movement and cure people's pain. And, you know, fun fact, if you go in as a patient into a physical therapy clinic, you tend to start venting to your physical therapist. And so you start to also be like a psych person as well. Anyways, going into trying to get my way into a doctorate for physical therapy, this was in the middle of 2017. And I realized I'm about to be just overwhelmed with student debt going down this journey that no one's been done before. There's a ton of bureaucracy. You're going to have to get three degrees. And so I discovered that my gaming computer that I had a single GPU in it, could mine this Ethereum thing for $5 a day. And I'm like, oh, $5 a day. That's what people like cut out of their lives when they stop going to Starbucks every single morning, right? Let's start accruing some savings. And so I took what little capital I had and put it into a mining operation, and went from one GPU to 27 GPUs in like different corners of my dad's house. And I was fully invested in this thing. And I still actually didn't know what Ethereum was. And so that what started to get me to go down the rabbit hole, started reading white papers because this was the ICO era, and started watching Vitalik YouTube videos and really started to like get my head wrapped around this thing. And I just got entranced by it. I never actually really went down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, the whole like unpacking proof of work, unpacking all that, kind of just got the gist of like hard cap money outside the banks. Didn't really entice me. But the whole like talks that Vitalik would give is like, oh, it's you can put arbitrary code into this thing. I didn't really know what that meant, but I knew that like it could do anything. I just didn't know how that would work. And to this day, I'm still figuring out like how you can actually do anything on Ethereum. But that's a problem for the developers. They keep on solving these problems. At some point in time, I decide to actually just go to ETH Denver in 2018. This was in February, and the plan was Friday, Saturday, I would go to the ETH Denver Hackathon Community Conference, experience the vibe there. And then on Sunday, I would go to Boulder and investigate the physical therapy school that they had there. Went to the ETH Denver conference, didn't understand a whole lot, like was very overwhelmed, but the vibes that I got, the conversations that I had, the people that I met after like a very like long time of like going from social group to social group and not fully feeling a part of every social group that I've been a part of throughout my life, like fraternity in college, football in high school, like didn't completely mesh with everyone. All of a sudden I go into this Ethereum community conference and it just completely resonated with almost everyone I met there. And so Sunday came, it was time for me to go to Boulder to investigate the physical therapy school there. And I was like, F it. No, I don't want to do that. I'm going to figure out how to go crypto full time. And so I remember like sitting down at ETH Denver, like self-reflecting is like, yo, I do not know what is going on here, but whatever it is, I'm not going to miss it. I can't miss this. And it was actually a pretty easy decision to make when the world of crypto and Ethereum is about the re-evolution of finance and money, whereas the other path I had was like, you know, 12 years of schooling and a bunch of student debt. So like the cost benefit of those things was pretty nice. That's how I got started. Didn't really know what I could do, not a developer, not a coder. So I just started writing. Turns out I'm a decent writer. And then started writing just more about what I saw. Like Ryan said, I started writing a lot about MakerDAO. Started my own podcast called POV Crypto with a co-host of mine. That was like a big bear market podcast, investigating the differences between Bitcoin and Ethereum. And then that's when I really got my podcasting skills up and running. And at this point, I was getting closer and closer to Ryan. And I kept on hounding him, like, Ryan, like, we got to start the Bankless podcast. Got to start the Bankless podcast. At some point, Ryan capitulated. And then here we are today.
Awesome. Yeah,
David told me I'd get addicted to it, and sure enough, like it's over, man. This podcasting is great. It's a fantastic way to build a community and get a message out.
Yeah, I'm curious. Has your YouTube channel like overtaken the audio podcast, or where does that stand between those two?
I don't really delineate between the two. The number of views on YouTube is significantly way more than the number of views on the podcast. Sure, but like it's in my mind, it's just like two formats.
Sure. Yeah. All right. I want to dive into Ethereum here. So what is the core kind of essence of your bullishness on Ethereum long term? So, for example, and let's try to pare it down into something that folks can understand in a super easy way. For example, Bitcoin has all this digital gold type of analogy, you know, where whoever it is, they could just kind of say, oh, okay, it's like gold, but a digital format. Some people kind of will say that Ethereum, even though it could have more potential, it doesn't have as clear of an analogy, let's say, to gold. What is kind of, how would you explain Ethereum in a way that captures this essence, but also kind of, you know, captures the bullishness that you guys have behind it?
Yeah, I think Ryan will do a really good job explaining that. And I actually kind of want to approach this from a slightly different angle. The reason why I find myself compelled to Ethereum is because there is this grand problem when we discovered this thing called cryptocurrency. Bitcoin invented it. Now we have this industry. There's this grand problem of how do we design a crypto economic system, a blockchain system to work? And one of the things that I've come to I've now realized is that there are many, many different ways to construct a blockchain. But the best ways, the long-term sustainable ways, will all converge upon the same construction. There's a certain amount of logical conclusion that with all the different design spaces that you can make a blockchain, you can tinker with decentralization, you can tinker with throughput, but ultimately all things will converge upon the same logical conclusion. And this is what Ethereum has really, really done well, and why Ethereum is what it is because the Ethereum ecosystem has funded our R&D efforts way more than any other ecosystem. And these R&D efforts have come to our efforts to try and explain and figure out what is the actual logical conclusion of a long-term, sustainable, secure crypto economic system. And so the argument is that all successful blockchains will eventually collapse upon the same model. And this is the thankfully, because of the Ethereum researchers who are committed to free open source software and cryptography, they have tried to figure out, like, how do we maximize everything about a blockchain in ways that is long-term sustainable? And so these developers have come to this logical conclusion, which we are calling this modular blockchain design, which allows for the three components of what makes a blockchain to each be maximized in their own right without one compromising the other. So we have consensus, which is decentralization. We have execution, which is like, can you actually scale out your blockchain to support the whole entire world? And then we have data availability, which is how much data can a blockchain support. These are the three things that makes a blockchain. The Ethereum system has been trying to research ways into maximizing all of these things. And the reason why I'm particularly bullish on Ethereum is I think the developers around Ethereum have really cracked the problem. It was like a big puzzle that they have collectively been working on. And they, in my mind, they have cracked the code to make the world's most sustainable, most secure, most scalable blockchain. And this is something that is independent from Ethereum. Ethereum is maybe just the first system to crack this code, but there are other systems as well that are also following in this roadmap that lend itself to the evidence that there is one grand construction, and that grand construction is going to be the system that you know, takes over the whole entire world.
Got it.
Yeah, Ryan, I would kind of build on that maybe. So like, I guess there's so many ways to sort of address those. I think you're right, Dave, that like, Bitcoin has had this mimetic advantage in that, like you just say, it's like gold, but it's digital. Okay. But that is also a very limiting meme. Okay. It's almost like this term has become popular, like a skeuomorphic design, right? So like the early, you know, websites on the internet were just replicas of newspapers, like magazines, which is put a website on them. But then we figured out all the things we could actually do with the internet. And then it got more interesting. We have Twitters and Facebooks and like more interactive pages. I think Bitcoin is kind of a skeuomorphic design of gold, right? It has to be fixed cap. It's like creating money. I think Ethereum is a much more interesting project in that it is going far beyond Bitcoin. In fact, I think it's achieving, it's like not a fork of Bitcoin, but it's like from a social perspective, it almost is, because it's achieving a lot of the promises that the early Bitcoin crypto community actually had. Like even the cypherpunks, right? Like the true kind of crypto natives who were trying to create this digital property rights system, the self-sovereign digital property rights system that they could, you know, collectively coordinate over. This is what Ethereum is. But to get like, I guess, pretty practical, I think the thing that we are building in crypto is a decentralized trust layer, okay? We are building a property rights system for the metaverse, okay? So like Facebook, metaverse, like talking about that, you can't have a metaverse without digital property rights, without self-sovereignty, without individual ownership, okay? And this has to be credibly neutral, has to be decentralized, or else it doesn't work. No one else is going to build on it. You know, the Chinese government is not going to build on Facebook Meta, okay? They're just not. They're not going to build on something that the U.S. creates, right? It has to be credibly neutral, available for the world, the way TCP/IP works as a protocol. So if you think that we're building this trust layer, basically, and like money is just one use case of this trust layer, but it's a very important trust layer, then you start to ask the question, what kinds of things can we build? And, you know, one thing that we can build is an entire bankless financial system, no intermediary in the middle, just a money system from the ground up that does not require a bank. You can actually be your own bank, okay? And of all the projects out there, the two that are really competing in this are like Bitcoin and Ethereum, because in order to build a bankless money system, you actually have to have a non-sovereign currency with monetary premium at the bottom, right? Bitcoin has that, Ether has that. A lot of the other chains like don't have that. So there's really like kind of the bull case for Ethereum is like, it's like Bitcoin, except it has DeFi. Okay. It's like a money system like Bitcoin, but it has a decentralized banking system on top of it. So it's like the best of both. And then it's also a property rights system for the metaverse. And the reason David and I are ultra bullish on Ethereum in particular versus other projects that purport to do this is, I guess I would say the thing that Bitcoin, that crypto chains are trying to scale is like what we call economic bandwidth, economic throughput, like the value of the asset itself and, you know, the security behind that asset. It's like the value of Bitcoin actually matters. People don't understand this, but like the value of Bitcoin is liquidity. It's security of the chain, matters a whole bunch. The value of Ether as an asset matters too. We have to scale the value of Ether in order for it to be a global settlement layer for the world. Okay. So that matters. And also transaction throughput matters. Trustless transactions per second matter. And we believe Ethereum has the best roadmap to accomplishing both. And we talk about like two things often. One, ultrasound money, which is the path to more scalable, trustless economic bandwidth. It's basically why ETH is going to continue to appreciate in value and hit 5K and then hit 10K and then hit 100K and beyond. Like this thing is going to be worth trillions in terms of value because of its properties. We could talk about ultrasound money and what that actually means. And the other piece of this, which was what David was talking about, is its modular design for scalability. And we talk about that as like ultra scalable Ethereum. Okay, so we have ultrasound money, and then we have ultra scalable Ethereum. People make the mistake right now. There's this narrative that like Ethereum's not scaling. No, it is scaling. Okay, DYDX is on Ethereum right now, and it's scaling. It's the largest decentralized derivatives market. Okay, we got Starkware technology that's out there. We've got Diversify. We've got all of these rollups. It is scaling. It's just not sacrificing decentralization in order to scale. Okay. So I guess if you boil this all down, we could get into those two categories specifically, but we see Ethereum building the most economically secure layer. That means ETH the asset price number go up. Okay. Like that's what I'm talking about here. Like the price is going to go up. The market cap is going to go up, and it has the best scalability strategy, because if you're just increasing block size, or if you're sacrificing decentralization, you're not really scaling. Okay. All of the chains that do that, it's not true scalability. But the modular design that Ethereum is taking, with like basically separating the different layers, as David said, where you've got consensus, data availability, and you've got this execution layer and this rollup centric design, that's going to scale to like millions of transactions per second over the next decade. So, like, these two things, no other chain has this. And that's why we think that other chains are going to be important. Crypto banks, exchanges are going to be important. But Ethereum is going to be the economic nexus of all of these things. It's going to be the base settlement layer for the world for those two reasons. And again, we could get into some of those specifics about like the merge and what's coming and what we mean by ultrasound money. But those are the two buckets, I would say.
There's a nice mental model that I really like that Ryan was really alluding to. And we have this spectrum of decentralization to scale. And there's Bitcoin on the very, very far decentralization side of the spectrum. And Bitcoin is actually consolidated and like eliminated so many different things that are not about BTC, the asset, away from Bitcoin. It's really about minimizing, just to maximize what Bitcoin is, which is the 21 million hard cap. And it's in that process, it's actually sacrificed the ability to host DeFi on it, right? Bitcoin, you can't have native DeFi on it because Bitcoin does one thing and one thing alone, which is focus on BTC, the asset. On the very other end of the spectrum, we have these very, very expressive, high throughput chains that are getting a lot of adoption right now because there's a lot of demand to do crypto stuff. This is what happens in bull markets. So we have these very, very high throughput chains, the Solanas of the world, the Trons of the world. There's a lot of these that come up, especially during bull markets. And that's because people are used to this whole Web 2 world where they press a button and then it executes. They're not used to the slower nature of decentralized systems that take time. And so we have these very large, like high throughput, high transaction activity. You can do anything on these type chains. But those chains have also sacrificed decentralization. Where Bitcoin sacrificed DeFi, the other chains have sacrificed decentralization and moneyness, right? Bitcoin, very, very much money. These other coins, well, because they are centralized, because they have sacrificed what it means to be a decentralized crypto economic network just to support this like DeFi on steroids, they've actually lacked the ability to be a global, credibly neutral settlement layer, because it's only a few nodes instead of the global set of nodes. There's only a few people managing the chain instead of many of us. And that is, and the reason why people like find these new chains and fall in love with them, because they are used to the same experience of a Web2 website. It's because it is closer to a Web2 website. That's how it works. They've gone from, instead of 10,000 nodes like Bitcoin and Ethereum, down to 50 to 1,000 nodes, which, you know, Facebook, Google, they have a lot of databases out there. They have like, Google is like, I don't know, 100 databases. And that this is similar. The reason why people adopt these things is because it feels and acts like what they're used to. But what they're not used to is decentralization and censorship resistance and permissionlessness. And this is why Ethereum has found the Goldilocks zone of somewhere right in the middle of these things, where it still has the properties of decentralization of Bitcoin, which imbues the moneyness into the L1 asset. And then in addition to having that, it also can have DeFi on top of it. And there's a very symbiotic relationship between the DeFi financial activity that goes on top of Ethereum and the relationship between Ether, the asset. Because demand to use Ethereum generated by the DeFi economy that's on top of it, ultimately that creates scarcity in Ether, the asset. And Ether, the asset, had one of the strongest monetary premiums in all of crypto. And you don't see that on these other high throughput chains, because they've sacrificed their monetary premium by sacrificing decentralization. So Ethereum really has found itself in this Goldilocks zone of both extremely decentralized to be extremely censorship resistant, to be out of bounds for any corporate means or government means or nation state means, yet and then instills the moneyness inside of that, and then also has DeFi on top of it to allow for this decentralized banking layer that allows for everyone to be a king and not just a few kings that control the protocol.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I mean, this is actually fantastic. I want to dive actually deeper into this, into some of these concepts. So I want to throw out a couple things to you guys, see if anything you guys have feedback in, or if you resonate with anything. So it seems to me like you have, you know, this blockchain technology came along and Bitcoin was one of the first to really, you know, crystallize it into this killer user proposition of, you know, kind of money or assets, right? And it seems to me that ETH came along and Ethereum, and it saw a bigger kind of purpose or bigger potential behind the blockchain, not to just hold asset, right? A digital type of gold or store of value, and not just, for example, the role of money, but Ethereum came along and saw this potential of like everything can be traded, like everything can be tokenized or made into something where if you don't have any barriers, you can become kind of like, you can create your own economy, you know? And the Ethereum, to me, it kind of strikes me as more of a parallel economy, a global economy that could be much larger potentially than even this physical, you know, real world economy. And I think Ethereum taps into that, whereas Bitcoin, it kind of is stuck in this kind of, I want to say box, but in this older kind of, you know, thought where it's like, it's all about preserving your store value, right? It's all about just like the old concept of money, whereas Ethereum seems to kind of turbocharge or supercharge what a blockchain can do. And I mean, the best thing like I've seen is like, you know, the analogy of Ethereum being a whole parallel economy, you know, that you can do everything in the physical economy, but even better, cheaper, more efficient. And when you add property rights to this whole thing where you can, you know, everything I would say non-negotiable, immutable, where if you own something, you own it, and it can be exchanged without friction at a super efficient kind of cheap price, and it could be exchanged to anything and everything, and the whole world can be participants. It seems like an entire different paradigm of economy, economic value, value creation, property ownership. And I'm bullish on Bitcoin as an asset in the sense that I think there's a value for that. But Ethereum just seems like it's a 10x bigger, or even more than that, bigger vision or scope. What are you guys' thoughts on that?
I think one analogy that we use so often on Bankless is the analogy of kind of the economy, as you said, in the nation state, right? So like Bitcoin figured out that the separation of money and the nation state is a good thing, okay? Well, Ethereum is separating the economy from the nation state. And that's an even bigger thing, because that money is contained within the economy, but so is everything else, right? Balaji Srinivasan, he talks about this concept of a network state, basically. So like, so much of what we require the nation state for is really like security and property rights. Like it's a trust machine. It's a social construct that we have created. And this is the modern nation state, the last 150 years or so, the birth of the nation state. Well, we are moving, humanity is moving collectively to better organizational systems. And this is, I think, blockchains are the first crypto native organizational systems that humanity has really tapped into and unleashed. And what Ethereum has discovered is like, yeah, we can create a money, but we can also create an entire economy on the other side of this, with a set of GDP and a set of creators. And like, so think about the analogies here. Every time, what's a DAO? A DAO is a C corp. It's an LLC, right? Like in the analog world, you have to register your LLC in the state of Delaware, for instance, right? On Ethereum, it's an ETH address and you register it to mainnet Ethereum, right? Like that's kind of the network state. And like, I mean, I'm sure had different LLCs and corporations you've been a part of in the past. It kind of sucks. It's like a hard process to go register in a corporation. If you want to collaborate with others, just in your own country, it's difficult too. Every state has a different set of laws. In the US, if you want to collaborate and invite someone in from a different country, it's like impossible. By the way, LLCs and C corps, they're not programmable, right? It doesn't come connected with its own banking system, okay? The way a DAO does. And so this is another example of like, we play in both worlds. We have an LLC, but we have a DAO. My God, it's so much easier to register a DAO and to manage it in DeFi than on Ethereum. And that's with the clunky UX that we have in 2021. Imagine how different this will be in like 2025. We will have leapfrogged past the nation state, and it'll be so much more attractive to register a DAO versus an LLC, okay? That's just one example. Another example is, of course, money. And in Ethereum, we have, it's a poly-asset ecosystem unlike Bitcoin. So you have ETH, which is kind of the most, crypto-native, most trustless asset on top of Ethereum. It exists, it's almost like a Bitcoin for Ethereum, if you will. And it has some super unique properties, by the way, that are different from the fiat system. EIP 1559, it's tied directly into the economy, right? So like if you're an owner of ETH, every time there is a gas fee transaction, a portion of that ETH gets burnt. So it's like a dividend that you receive just by being an owner of ETH for tax revenue. How weird is that? You don't get that in fiat. When I pay my taxes in fiat, it's not like the IRS burns those taxes and gives it back to me as a dollar holder. Well, that's what Ethereum is doing. So ETH the asset is this new unique money in this network state economy, if you will. And then we have this like incredible financial system, like a financial system that right now seems small, but it is already better in so many ways than the existing legacy financial system. And it is getting better and better every day. Okay. We have like 500 or so executives in the banking system, that are making the decisions and governing banks. Well, we have like tens of thousands of developers now in Ethereum that are like can start a protocol from their garage and literally have more capabilities than the banking system. It's like 500 banking executives versus tens of thousands of developers, right? And in these battles with OpenSea, like who's going to win that? We are going to have the best financial system on the planet. It's already better in some ways. It's getting exponentially better every single year. So we've got that piece of it. And we have things you can't even do in the physical realm, right? As humanity transitions into the digital, like things like NFTs, that's a net new use case. So anyway, all of this activity, basically, this is the story of the internet, which is humanity's transition into the digital And now this Act 3, some people call this Web 3. This is us figuring out how to do property rights, self-sovereign property rights on the internet. And that's what Ethereum is providing. And it, yeah, it's like a nation state, because it's like, but it's better. It's internet native. It's more credibly neutral. The thing about the nation state is, like, none of us decided where we were born. Okay. Like, we had no options in it. And what's great about blockchains and Ethereum is it's completely opt-in. So you get to choose. You want to be part of Bitcoin? You want to be part of Ethereum? Right? Like, you're not forced into those decisions. It's opt-in. It's bottom-up in its approach. It's also completely open, transparent, credibly neutral. Everyone abides by the exact same rules. If you want to understand what the laws are in the land, you right-click and you look and, you know, view the source. You can see exactly what's going to be executed. There's no kings, as David was talking about, who get to decide. There's no elite class who gets special privileges in this world. And it's just a new paradigm, I think, for humanity. And yeah, that's why I feel like with crypto, Bitcoin was just the start. Okay, we're just scratching the surface. And it's retrospectively, it's like so limiting. It's just like one use case. And Ethereum enables so many more. I don't know what you'd add to that, David. You're muted.
Thank you. One of the big bull cases for Bitcoin is that it is the first currency that can transcend all nation states, right? Currencies, fiat currencies, the dollar, they stop at the border, right? Once you go into Mexico, like, you have to use a different currency. That nation state pays taxes in that currency. So currencies are very siloed until Bitcoin comes around. And we for the first time have a currency that can transcend all nation states, one global currency. Well, now with Ethereum, it's the same thing, but now not just with Ethereum, but also with an economy. We, for the first time ever, have an economy that can transcend all nation states. A lot of banking stops at the border because of regulations and top-down control by nation states. And for the first time ever, not only does Ethereum bring along its own native currency, but it brings along an economy, a financial fabric that just blankets the whole world. And the only thing that you need in order to access Ethereum is an Ethereum address and an internet connection. And Ethereum lets you go from there. And that is unprecedented. What happens when every single human is on the same money protocol and the same exact economy protocol? What happens when we're all using the same financial tools across the whole globe equally? What happens if the access that someone has in sub-Saharan Africa to financial tooling is the same access that somebody has on Wall Street in New York? And all of humanity is really a story of trying to get coordinated with each other. There's this great problem that people think that it's like us versus them. It's the 99% versus the 1%. It's the left versus the right. If you zoom out and take a more neutral approach, it's really us versus us. Can we actually coordinate as humans to be on the same page as everything else? And it's not about us versus them. It's really us versus us. And Ethereum and these coordination protocols allows everyone to be on the same page in a way that we've never actually been able to discover before.
You know what's super cool about this too, Dave, is like we didn't have to make the trade-off that we had to make with the nation state, okay? So Thomas Hobbes, the philosopher, Dave's written about this before, it's this concept called the Leviathan, which is basically like, in order to get better coordination capabilities, the thing that we've given the nation state is a weapon, the weapon of violence, the ability to like put people in jail, the ability to like a monopoly on violence, basically, okay? Ethereum, this entire network state economy, does not require any violence. It's all managed through capital.
It doesn't have the capacity for violence.
Yeah, the security is not maintained by a military and like fighter jets and like navy and, you know, armed forces. The security is economic and decentralization. So we've accomplished this not only without violence, but also at a fraction of the cost of the nation state. Think of how much bureaucracy is involved in spinning up a nation state economy, okay? And like a nation state banking system and all of the like judges and, you know, court system and like police force, all of this infrastructure. And now humanity has just figured out a way to do it at a fraction of the cost. That's why when people are like, oh, you know, the gas fees on Ethereum mainnet are high, I'm just like, number one, scalability, okay? So, like, we're going to do all of this stuff in rollups, and it's going to be a fraction of a cent to transmit funds. So don't worry, that's coming. But number two, compared to what? Like, do you know how much registering an LLC actually costs? If you factor in, like, the military and the buildings and, like, the government apparatus and the bank, like, all of the structure that's required to actually register that LLC, go factor that in the price. And, like, a $5 gas fee on Ethereum to register your DAOs is pretty damn cheap, right? So that's the other thing I feel like we've unlocked. And that's why crypto is people don't realize this yet, but crypto is it is a huge milestone in the human journey. Like, our journey as a species and the journey of civilization, I think, is going to be, like, the hallmark of the 21st century. This is going to change everything, this next act of the internet.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, okay, lots of stuff here. So I like the analogy of, you know, you've got this, maybe Bitcoin started with the money protocol, but then you have Ethereum coming along as this economy protocol. It would seem to me that, you know, with Bitcoin, they've taken kind of the store of value narrative, and, you know, part of crypto is this kind of trading, making money, you know, either holding or trading. And like with Bitcoin, we've seen a lot of, you know, people profit from trading or mostly holding. But it seems like in terms of Bitcoin as money, as actually transferable, like day-to-day use of money, that vision has never been realized per se. But it seems like if you create an economy, for example, with the Ethereum vision, it seems like money will just fit in and play a role underneath that economy. And it seems like if there was a blockchain to bet on, you know, fulfilling the vision of money, would you say it's Ethereum over Bitcoin? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I would definitely say that. And this is like how the U.S. became the world reserve currency, basically through the strength of its economy, right? And this is the path that that Ethereum is taking. It's not taking a path through a digital gold, digital scarcity meme per se, although it has some strengths there that we should talk about. But it's taking a path to monetary supremacy through the value of its economy. And that takes the form of so many things. David touched upon, like, DeFi, okay? So Ether is the most trustless collateral for DeFi. If you take out a Maker loan, you're going to get special rights and special privileges when you use Ether to back that, okay? All of the trading volume on Uniswap, the biggest pair by far, is Ether, okay? So Ether is the reserve money for the Ethereum economy, the way the U.S. dollar is the reserve money for the U.S. economy. Another way this factors in is, you know, the U.S. dollar has reigned supreme. We're just talking to Christian Carlo, who is the former CFTC chair of the CFTC. So he knows a lot about commodities. And he talked about, like, in our conversation with him, about how the U.S. has retained its monetary supremacy of the dollar because it is the unit of account, is the money for commodities. So oil, wheat, you know, gold, all global commodities are exchanged and denominated in the dollar, okay? Well, Ethereum actually has one of the most valuable future commodities of the metaverse, and that is Ethereum block space, okay? A seven-day time period last week, $70 million in revenue sold by the Ethereum network, okay? What does a blockchain actually sell? It sells blocks. People forget this. Okay, that is the product of Apple sells iPhones, Facebook sells eyeballs, blockchains sell blocks. Ethereum is selling blocks at a massive rate, and all of those blocks are denominated in Ether, the asset. It's interesting too, going off the tangent block space sales. If you were to actually look at the revenue of all block space sales, like layer one blockchains, over the past 7 days, not this week, but the week before, when I last looked at this, Ethereum had 100x the sales revenue on its block space versus Bitcoin. Okay. Take all of the other layer ones, so-called, Ethereum would be 91% of all block space value sold. Right. And if you translate that to market cap, it's obviously market cap is different. There's a delta there. You don't know, but like imagine if Ethereum market cap was 91% of all crypto layer one market cap. Arguably, it should be because it has the most valuable product, which is block space, and all of that block space is denominated in Ether. So yeah, there's a lot of I guess tailwinds for Ether the asset. In this world too, and that's also why it has more potentials, because the asset with the highest value ultimately becomes the most economically secure network, and you know that's what at the end of the day this whole thing is a battle for. All these crypto networks are competing to have the greatest amount of security and decentralization. So Ethereum has a pretty good path to get there.
I want to take what Ryan said and put that back into my framing of that spectrum where we have Bitcoin as this very, very consolidated, collapsed use case focused on decentralization and BTC only. And then we have the high throughput chains, and put that into a framing of exactly what Ryan was just saying about block space. Ryan also said earlier that these systems don't protect themselves by militaries, right? They don't, not by just injecting money into military, they protect themselves economically. And when people are paying that super high fees for that block space, when all that block space revenue is coming in, that's what we're talking about. That is the security around the system. So instead of, you know, F-35 fighters, we have people paying gas fees on Ethereum. Those are the equivalents of this like old world to this new world. And when we have this Bitcoin thing, which is money, and people really, really hold it, the reason why Bitcoin is being dwarfed by Ethereum in transaction fees is because there isn't DeFi on top of it. There isn't this utility layer to do the things. There's just Bitcoin. And what is Bitcoin really meant to do? It's meant to be held, not to be transacted. And then on the other side, we have the big high throughput chains, and the high throughput chains, the things that have very, very cheap fees with a lot of transaction volume, they've actually sacrificed their ability to protect themselves, because what they are really selling as a product is cheap block space, right? Like low transaction fees. And so a lot of the low transaction fee use cases have gone on to these high throughput layer ones. And so where Bitcoin has lost its security by not having a high enough utility to make its block space valuable, the other side of the spectrum is that these high throughput chains has devalued their block space by giving out way too much supply of it. So going back down to that Goldilocks zone, where Ethereum has a very constrained layer one, where the blocks are very, very full, very, very in demand, and not a lot of supply, which is causing a lot of ire for people who want to transact on the L1. This is where Ethereum gets its very high security, where Ether gets a lot of its monetary premium, because all of these blocks have so much utility. You can do so many things inside of an Ethereum block that you can't do elsewhere. And that this lends itself to the layer two conversation, where people that are really demanding those less than sub one penny transactions and super low latencies, those are actually going to be done on layer twos. And the layer twos are actually going to be the things that ultimately are the aggregate purchasers of layer one block space. And so where you have like blockchains that like sell blocks to individuals, like, oh, I would like to purchase this amount of block to do this thing that I want to do. In the future, Ethereum will sell its block space to other blockchains. It'll be blockchains that consume Ethereum's block space. And those blockchains will have this cryptographic link to Ethereum itself. That's what rollups are. And so really, this is where we get, again, the best of both worlds. This goes back to the modular design I was talking about, where people will live on these layer twos that feel and act like web two. You press a button, the thing happens instantaneously, but it's secured by that hyper decentralization, hyper secure layer one that is Ethereum.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Okay, so if ETH or Ethereum is ultrasound money and Ethereum is ultra scalable, how can you guys remain bullish on Bitcoin? I mean, does, like, over time, you know, if Ethereum holds kind of this and grows in this value proposition of being an economy, but also ultrasound money and store of value, where does Bitcoin's role fit?
It really depends on the time frame, in my mind. I mean, it depends, are you asking about the next 5 to 15 years, or you are asking about like the logical conclusion of these whole things? Because I'm just as bullish as anyone on Bitcoin over the next, I don't know, 2 decades or so. the thing about Bitcoin is that it has this halving model, right, where the issuance of Bitcoin cuts in half every single every 4 years, and it asymptotally approaches 21 million. That is its security budget running out over time. And so Bitcoin, while it had this fantastic start, as it goes on, it becomes less and less secure as things go on. And so that these issues that will arise won't arise for 2-3 decades, but eventually they will arise, because Bitcoiners love to talk about the assurances of Bitcoin's monetary policy. It has a 21 million hard cap. That's what it's promised. On the flip side, you are also assuring your security levels. Your security levels are also going down. And again, where Bitcoin is really just meant to be held, it can't figure out how to incentivize people paying fees to the blocks, to the blockchain, to incentivize the security. People just hold the damn thing. So if you're asking about, like, what do I think Bitcoin will do in the short term? Great things. It's really going to go to a very incredibly high number, probably. Over the long term, the system starts to break down and starts to get more and more insecure. And it's really a game of just like, when does, these are very hard concepts to understand. It took me and Ryan years to figure this out, and then more years to actually be able to articulate this thing. But as more and more society starts to realize that the security of Bitcoin is not sustainable to host a global financial system, I think people will start to reevaluate Bitcoin and start to look for security elsewhere. And that's where the fee conversation comes in. So, Dave, to answer your question directly, over the long term, I don't see a place for Bitcoin in this world. I don't see how it fits.
Got it.
I mean, David and I are big believers in the flippening, right? Like, we think it's inevitable and it'll probably happen like relatively soon. I think I used to be more bullish on Bitcoin as a hedge against, like, what if Ethereum fails? Okay. Mm-hmm. But like with each passing month, each passing milestone, each massive move in terms of like scalability, that becomes less likely, I think. So it's been a long time since I've purchased any Bitcoin, like years. Okay. But I've not stopped purchasing Ether. I'm also not selling personally a lot of the Bitcoin I hold, right? So again, having kind of that hedge is interesting. But Raoul Paul likes to make the point too. He's like, I don't know why. He says, I don't know why I hold Bitcoin, because in a bull market, Ether's going to overperform, right? And in a bear market, I'd rather have dollars than both of them. So like, why hold Bitcoin? And I also sort of understand that argument as well. Our approach is like, it can be a component of your portfolio, but if you believe in this Ether thing, it's probably a smaller component of your portfolio.
Got it. Do you guys have an opinion on when's the best time to buy Ethereum? Let's say if you, you know, are convinced, you know, with Ethereum's future, do you wait for an inevitable pullback? Let's say, you know, you're wanting to build a position. Do you say, hey, I'll wait for a 50% pullback because, you know, crypto always seems to pull back at some time? Or do you just like dollar cost average in and just, you know, forget it and say, I'm not going to look at the price, just every month put in some and just, you know, hope over the long term it just keeps on going up? What's your thoughts?
There's this comic that I love. It's, I think the kid is called Billy, and the father hands Billy a dollar and he says, Billy, it's time you learn the value of a dollar. And then in the next frame, Billy already has it going into a vending machine. And then in the crypto world, the vending machine is Ether, right? And so I try and be responsible and like hold on to a nice balance of dollars and not go too far. But like, watching my behavior in the past, it just ultimately just goes into Ethereum. And so I'm generally a non-holder of dollars. And whenever I have dollars, I turn it into Ethereum more or less the first chance that I get.
Yeah, I think waiting. So first of all, I should say, like, neither David and I are traders, right? Yes. So like, we can't tell you how to trade like locally something in a 3 month, 6 month time period. So our best advice is always like, when's the best time to buy Ether? Yesterday. When's the second best time? Today. And keep, like, whether you buy in a bulk or you dollar cost average in, just it's, your holding horizon has got to be long term. Okay. So like, you're actually, I mean, if you zoom out, crypto has never had a bear market, right? If you zoom out, I mean, like, how far do you have to, well, we're at all time highs now, but like at any point in time in Ethereum's history, if you zoomed out 3 years, you're in the green, yep, fairly healthily in the green, right? And so like, what frustrates me about the crypto industry writ large is almost that people are so obsessed with asking that question of like, should I wait for the pulp? Am I too late? It's like, no, you're not too late. Okay, not if we're right. You're not too late. And like, you should get in now and should plan to hold for the long run. Don't play a short-term game. Let's watch this thing develop. And I would say the last thing on this is like, there have been times in crypto's history and Ethereum's history that I've been worried about execution risk, for instance, right? Like this whole ETH2 thing back in 2018. What is it? Is it going to ship? Proof of stake? Is it actually coming? I have never been more confident in Ethereum's roadmap and its future from an execution perspective, right? Like, there's no doubt in my mind that the things that we're talking about are actually going to happen. I have previously been worried about product market fit, right? It's like, will anyone buy Ethereum block space? Like, you know, does anyone want a JPEG? Right? Like, what are these NFT things? Are they gonna, is DeFi going to take off? I'm no longer worried about that right now. So like, we're fourth quarter 2021. So much of the execution risk and product market fit risk has been boiled out of this thing. And so I guess I would also flip the question and be like, I don't know, what are you waiting for? Right? Like a 25% pullback, this thing could 2x like in a few days, but by the time you transfer your funds to Coinbase, right? So like, stop waiting. You probably should have bought before. Like, you know, don't risk more than you can like afford, but get into this asset class. It's always a mistake to wait.
Mm-hmm. Sure. If the answer is I own zero Ether, then I think you should consider purchasing Ether as not just a financial investment, but also motivation to learn. And so if you don't have Ether, you're going to learn a lot faster if you actually do own some. You're going to be incentivized to learn. Going back to my story about how I got into Ethereum, I put all this money into these GPUs because they were making me passive income. And then I inevitably had to actually learn what the hell the thing is I was mining. And in that process, I'm still going down that process, that rabbit hole today. There was exactly what Ryan was talking about with execution. We had a podcast with Preston Pish, who's a big Bitcoiner. And one of his big complaints or one of his big criticisms as to why he wouldn't buy Ether is because of the execution risk. And I love it when people say, oh, it's the execution risk, because that means when the execution risk passes, people are still going to be buying Ether when it's $10,000, right? Like, people will still be buying it once the execution risk has passed because that was their complaint. And so it's really a gamble on like, okay, do you want to buy it pre-execution and then receive the upside later? Or are you going to wait for the execution to pass? And granted, there's a reason why Ether is at $4,800 right now. A lot of execution has passed. EIP-1559, that was an idea for 2 years. Now it's a thing. Proof of stake, the beacon chain, that was an idea for years. Now it's a thing. There's not that much of Ethereum's roadmap left to be executed upon. And that's why Ryan is saying that he is so confident, is because we actually have things we can point at. It's like, look at what the developers promised. There was a lot of disappointment in the delays in that roadmap, but they are being delivered. And one of the big like memes in Ethereum is like, oh, when's that coming? I don't know, but it's coming. It always ends up coming.
Mm-hmm. Got it. For those watching, none of this obviously is financial advice. It's just, you know, some random opinions shared here. But what's your thoughts on price cycle? Obviously, there's, you know, lots of different people, you know, saying, hey, you know, crypto runs on a 4-year price cycle based off of Bitcoin halvening. Some people are saying, hey, this cycle is different because institutions have come along and it's going to, you know, Bitcoin and Ethereum are not going to have the same crash as it did before. What's your guys' take? Is there any rhyme or reason? And then there's a lot of people who are saying like, hey, I'm looking for, you know, the peak in the next, whatever, first half of 2022 to pull out or whatever. What's your take on price cycles?
I think the price cycle is more or less dead. I think crypto will always be pretty rocky. It'll always be a pretty fun ride for those that like volatility. Going through long-term bear markets like what we went through in 2018 and 2019, I think is dead. The evidence for that is that pre-2018-19, the 2017 bull market was completely sustained by just vapor and ideas and just empty promises. Whereas these days, there's the meme of the super cycle. Like, we had one bull market, but then we're gonna get a second bull market right after that. Maybe that's a little bit too bullish, But what I do think is happening is an adoption super cycle. There are many, many different reasons to use Ethereum, and there are sustainable long-term use cases, not just flash in the pans. And so, sure, maybe we see 50% drawdowns, which is, we'll throw anyone for a tizzy. But seeing those 85% plus drawdowns, I think, are a thing in the past, because there's just too much money on the sidelines waiting to get in. And there's too many use cases to be relevant for so many different people. And so this the whole market cycles thing, the whiplash of the 2011 bubble, the 2013 bubble, the 2017 bubble, that was speculation. And it was speculation that I think we would actually arrive to where we are today, where the whole entire world is figuring out what is crypto right now, and it's in a very sustainable fashion.
Yeah, David's probably a bit more a believer in like this idea of super cycles, like the 3 hours capital guys, than I am. I see that's a possibility, right? And the thesis of the super cycle is like, well, we'll have some things that are in a bear market, like DeFi for a period of time, but like, you know, or NFTs, and they'll cycle in and out. But collectively, crypto, the big assets, will never see, you know, 80, 90% type drawdowns. I'm not so sure. Like, I think that's one possibility, but I'd also leave room for like, hey, humans are humans. And while it's not a 2017 bubble, like, yeah, I mean, our bubble then was under $1 trillion. What if this asset class exploded to like $10-20 trillion? And this is totally within the realm of human psychology and possibility. Could it get overinflated to the point where it kind of needs to cool down and kind of needs to pop before, like, and so we can actually deliver on our promises? One thing I start to think of is like, a lot of people that I see, probably like over 50% now, that are in crypto have actually never felt the pain of a bear market. Like, they don't know that pain. They haven't felt it. And that starts to scare me, because you start to get a different set of a cohort of individuals who, they only know price go up. And so like, when price does go up, they just hit the, they start running. Okay. They're not holders. Okay. So like, I do think that this stuff can have a tendency to repeat. What I think, if this does cycle up and then there's a blow off the top, I don't think we'll ever see a 95% drawdown of Ether, but like, we might see an 80% drawdown. We might even see an 85% drawdown. Like, I'm not so sure, and I wouldn't discount that as a possibility. There are some assets right now that I feel like are overheated in crypto, let's just say, relative to the value that they're driving. And I don't know how much crazier it's going to get before something happens. So I just leave that possibility open as well.
Got it. I want to go through, I want to maximize my remaining time with you guys and go through some quick fire questions from some Twitter followers, and also some other things I had. Kigai from Twitter says, what's in your portfolio? Asking David and Ryan.
Hold on, let me pull it up. Mm-hmm. let's see. Okay, well, Ether is by and large the biggest one. I think that's like 70-ish%. And then I have something like the DeFi staples. Some people are calling these the boomer coins. MKR holds a very close place in my heart, just because it's, maybe I shouldn't be emotionally investing, but that was the first like DeFi app that I was really into. So I got the Uni airdrop, so I have my Uni tokens, have a few Aave tokens. And then there's like the newer cohort of DeFi, what we're calling DeFi 2.0 tokens. And so that's like Tokamak, Rari, Olympus DAO. But these are all very small percentages of my portfolio. Really, I kind of think that these tokens are all speculation in relation to Ether. I think Ether is very, very safe. These tokens are a little bit more speculation. Definitely real stuff there. But I, over the long term, I think it's kind of going to be really, really hard to outperform Ether. And then, of course, I also have a CryptoPunk, which actually represents a decent chunk of my net worth, which you can see behind me.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Let's check it out. There it is. Awesome.
I've always tried to keep this has fluctuated, but tried to keep a portfolio of like 60%, call it 50 to 60% of crypto monies. So like Bitcoin and Ether, and by far Ether for me is like the dominant crypto money. It's the one I'm most bullish about. And then another like 20 to 30% in kind of the banking layer, which is what I think of as DeFi tokens. Some people also invest in, like, you know, a Coinbase or a Binance in the banking layer. I'm not so bullish on these things. It didn't really fit my ethos, so I'm more on the DeFi side of things. But I understand why you'd hold exchange tokens as an asset class, or like stocks as an asset class. And then I have also tried traditionally to maintain like 10% in stablecoins, like generating yield as like dry powder, right? Because you never know, right? So it's like this, you know, 50%, you know, 50 to 60%, we'll call it 60%, 30%, 10% sort of split. Now, something has kind of changed within that portfolio mix for me. I still denominate things in Ether primarily as the money. So like when I make an investment, I don't want to make fiat-based returns. I want to make Ether-denominated returns, which is trickier. That's a lot harder. But the thing that's changed to me is like the category of that 30% or so that used to be just DeFi and crypto banks is now I've kind of expanded that into like metaverse-type investments. Okay, so like this is crypto gaming. It's going to be a huge thing. And this is like our entrant into the metaverse. So all of these, like the Axie Infinities of the world, is just one archetype, but that sort of layer is really interesting to me. So I try to keep some assets there. The other piece that's interesting is layer twos, quite frankly, which again, this is another Blockspace product, but it's not a money. It's not a crypto money. And so that's kind of invaded my DeFi portfolio mix a little bit. But at the end of the day, I do try to denominate things back in the crypto monies, which for me is Ether, and I'll allocate every once in a while to bring some of those earnings back to you, like the safe holds, which are primarily Ether and a little bit of Bitcoin.
Got it. Do you think there is going to be like a big layer two winner? Have you invested into anything that you think has a lot of potential?
I don't think there's going to be one winner personally, right? I think there's going to be category winners, right? There's probably going to be an optimistic roll-up kind of category winner or champion. ZK roll-ups are going to be absolutely huge, and those are a different category. There's another category of like, I think, privacy-focused roll-up chains that are going to be really important. I think Polygon has made sort of a name for itself. It's not a layer two specifically, is kind of a sidechain, but it's acquired Hermes and is moving into a layer two, but they've just crushed it as far as business development goes. Immutable X, right? So like, I think my strategy anyway is across all of those various layer twos right now. And I think there could be category winners. It's still super early to tell. And I want exposure into all of those different approaches to the layer two market.
Mm-hmm. The cool thing about layer twos is that they can be very, very specific to what they need to do, right? Where Ethereum is very, very general. Everyone has to conform to the EVM, the Ethereum protocol. Layer twos have much more freedom in actually doing different design spaces. And so there might be like one L2 per use case, right? I do find myself intrinsically attracted to optimism's flavor of optimistic rollups, and kind of when I started this podcast, I talked about the logical conclusion of blockchain design. I think there's also a logical conclusion of optimistic rollup design, and that is one that minimizes the difference between the EVM found on layer one, the Ethereum virtual machine, and the EVM that you find on layer twos, which use the EVM to settle to the EVM. Right. And so there's this famous EVM inside of an EVM problem, which is what optimistic rollups is, right? Like you have this execution environment on top of a layer two, and you want that to be compliant with the EVM because everything else in Ethereum is compliant with the EVM. But making an EVM a virtual machine that actually settles to itself, to another flavor of the EVM, is actually a hard problem, right? It's kind of like a snake biting its tail. The optimism team has gone after trying to tackle this problem. And they are going after not just EVM compatibility, as in like they've done a bunch of code to make the compatibility work, but they are going for EVM equivalence, which really results in actually, rather than adding more code to the optimistic rollups, reducing code. And so I think there's a world where there could be a blossoming of optimistic rollups, specifically because of how easy it is to copy and paste these things everywhere and still latch onto the same infrastructure that the Ethereum L1 has. So the node infrastructure, the tooling, the compilers, All this stuff that took years for Ethereum to build out in 2015 to 2017 now can just be instantaneously repurposed to an optimistic rollup that is specifically trying to minimize the difference between the EVM on the layer one and the EVM on the layer two.
Mm-hmm. Do you know one thing that kind of sucks though, Dave, for retail investors is very few of these layer twos actually have tokens that are publicly traded.
True. Okay.
So a lot of these are getting funded VCs, private deals. This is, you know, all thank you to the SEC kind of securities laws. Mm-hmm. So if you're like actually retail and you're looking to get exposure to this, like there's Polygon, there's like Loop Ring, there's more recently Immutable. But then what else do you do? Okay. Right. Like you can't get Optimism, you can't get Arbitrum, you can't get ZK Sync, you can't get Starkware, you can't get any of these things. So again, not financial advice, but just like, you know, I guess crypto advice. Probably the best way for you to get exposure to these things, if we're just projecting things forward, is just start using them. Okay. Because have we seen airdrops this year? Yes. Like, will we see airdrops next year? Yes, many more. Will all of these networks eventually tokenize, despite what they say? And David and I have no insider knowledge in these things. Yes, they will, right? Just like map out the incentives, connect the dots here. So like your retail, you want exposure to a layer two, you can't buy the token, start using it would be my non-financial advice. This is just usage advice, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I just got an ENS airdrop by, you know, purchasing an ENS domain a while back. Yeah, so it's like, hey, you know, free money.
Exactly.
Want more of that, we actually have a guide to airdrops that we posted on the Bankless ecosystem. So for if people want, there's like 25 of them. It's a guide to farming retroactive airdrops if they do come. It's kind of like shooting darts, but ENS was on there.
Yep. Great write-up. I definitely read it. Are you guys bullish on Axie Infinity? Do you think, like, what kind of challenges do you think they face? Do you think it's like kind of unclear their future, or do you guys really believe in, you know, where they're headed?
I'm bullish on their vision, and that vision can be completely separated from the price action. Again, the price action is a beast of its own. But what Axie Infinity wants to do, which is kind of make another a nation inside of a nation, right? We talked about how Ethereum is a global economy, global nation for all of us. Well, kind of think of like Ethereum as like the federal the Fed, right? Like the federal government of the United States. It controls everything. But then you can have like more states where Axie Infinity is like a state. It's like its own internal nation inside of this broader nation. And Axie Infinity is very, very intentional on the first game that they have. Axie Infinity is not the final game, nor is Axie Infinity in its final form. So they are very intentfully going after not just building out a game, but building out a whole entire economy, a whole entire nation. There's a reason why they call themselves the Axie Nation. And so I'm definitely bullish on that vision. And I think that vision can actually be repurposed every single time there's a crypto gaming that comes out.
Yeah, you know, and so like I think David's exactly right. Probably the most bullish thing to in my mind about Axie Infinity actually is the Ronin sidechain. Okay, so I see this becoming a roll up over time. And if you notice, Axie just added a decentralized exchange to the Ronin sidechain too. So they are developing their own kind of economy on the sidechain itself. And if you tether that and you outsource the economic security to Ethereum and you start to build other products, like let's not forget, Axie has probably onboarded more of the unbanked than any crypto application to date, right? How many people in the Philippines are using crypto because of Axie? Well, how can they parlay that to something different? What if you give all Axie users like a DeFi experience? So I think there's a lot of growth opportunities there. I think maybe the headwinds for Axie come with how do you make sure the game is fun? And the whole crypto gaming industry is struggling with this. It's like the true utility of the game is actually somebody has to want to have fun while playing it, or else it's just like a grind. Okay, and if everyone's just working and grinding and no one's actually having fun, the economy can tend to collapse in on itself. So I think there's a lot of discussion about this. How do we make sure that it's not just like a grind? How can we make sure the game mechanics are fun? Because ultimately, there has to be that, or else the economy can collapse. But overall, I'm pretty bullish. The question is just like, it's grown so fast. How much more can it grow compared to other like crypto gaming opportunities that are out there? I mean, mm-hmm. yeah. I mean, is this going to get to like trillions? Anyway,
definitely. Yeah, I mean, one of the things I'm seeing with crypto is, you know, it's giving people like a chance to own something that has huge possible huge potential in the future, and they can decide early on if they want to be a part owner of that. You know, and so I think there's this misconception. People think coins are all the same, like, you know, Bitcoin, Ethereum, or whatever, you know. But then there are a lot of coins that people call them coins, but they're actually, in a way, part ownership of a larger ecosystem that might make it, but it might not, you know, and it's a risk to take. But if it does make it, you've got that upside, you know, as a part owner into that ecosystem. But yeah, I mean, Axie just is just one of those examples. If it does, you know, take off, then early owners do have, you know, a part of the ownership of that, something that is you just don't get in traditional kind of private investing, you know, where you're boxed out of a lot of opportunities. A few more questions here. So, I want to talk about a few other blockchains here. So Solana, you guys have, you know, referred to Solana quite a few times here as kind of like, you know, sure, this blockchain does a ton of throughput, but it's sacrificing, you're saying, decentralization and security because of that, with lesser nodes, et cetera. You think Ethereum will win out overall. Does a Solana type of chain long-term, if they can improve security, improve decentralization over time, possibly, increase nodes and its decentralization, could that be a possible competitor to Ethereum? How do you see that play out?
I actually think Solana in its current form is the best way to compete with Ethereum, because if it does start to do that, Dave, and it does start to add in decentralization, it actually starts to turn into the same sort of design architecture that Ethereum is. And that goes back to what I was saying at the beginning. There is this one grand way to build out a blockchain, and any blockchain can start building in that direction. It's just that Ethereum has already been building in that direction, researching, like, you know, bushwhacking through the jungle, through the unknown, trying to figure out what this design is. And sure, it's made it very, very easy for other chains to follow in its path. I think Solana's big competitive advantage right now is actually having cheap fees, actually compromising on decentralization. And so, like, Solana is making a bet that a significant portion of the world actually doesn't care about decentralization. And, like, honestly, it's not the worst bet to make. The thing is, I was in NFT New York not too long ago at the NFT NYC conference, and I heard some people talking about, like, SHIB token. Like, dude, if it goes, it was the perfect meme that we hear in the crypto space, where the people who are talking about SHIB were saying, like, oh, if it goes to a penny, like, we'll all be rich. And so I kind of heard it out of the corner of my ear, didn't really hear everything. So I go over there and I start talking and say, hey, you guys are talking about SHIB, right? Just to be clear. And they said, yeah. And then they realized I was a crypto person. They didn't want to let me go. And one of the guys said the reason why he's bullish on Solana, after this conversation progressed a little bit, one of the reasons why he's bullish on Solana is because it's centralized enough to the point where the government is cool with it. Like, it's centralized so the governments are going to be okay with that. Because how do governments impose regulation and constraints? They go to the central entities. They go to the bottlenecks. And so, I mean, it's interesting that, like, this narrative is just, like, out there. Ultimately, the whole point about these systems, in my mind, is that these systems extend beyond the nation state, are not contained by the nation state. And so Solana has this, like, rock and a hard place where, yeah, it's getting all of this adoption because it sacrificed decentralization so it can get these fees. But the consequences of sacrificing decentralization over the long term is a pretty big obstacle to overcome. And so, yeah, Dave, if Solana wants to be long-term sustainable and not just like a 1 to 3 year flash in the pan, it is going to have to start constraining block space so that more nodes can run the chain and start syncing with the system and have more people adopt the system. But then it just gets closer and closer to Ethereum. Once you sacrifice, or once you actually start to try and decentralize the whole thing, then the fees are going to come. And what Solana has really advertised low fees. And once all the fees arrive, well, all the use cases that's built on Solana, which are surrounding low fees, are actually going to break. And so they're going to have to go on to a layer two on Solana. And that's layer two is going to be something like a roll-up. Meanwhile, Ethereum has already been executing on this roadmap that it figured out years ago and is already light years beyond it, because it never actually had to go through that. And meanwhile, and something that Ryan and I are big proponents of, is this prospect of credible neutrality. after Solana has been secured by a very few number of people backed by VCs, you've kind of soiled the credible neutrality of the thing. It's no longer a public, open, permissionless platform. It bestows the power, it's a kingmaker, right? It has made very few funds and very few central people with very low distribution of the SOL token the kings of the system. And one thing that we do not like in a bankless world is bankers. And when these things can control the users of the system, that is no longer a system where everyone is on equal footing. This is a differential. And so in my mind, in kind of the same way that Bitcoin is unsustainable long-term due to security, Solana is unsustainable long-term either due to being weak due to centralization, or it commits to following the path that Ethereum is already on.
Got it. A few other blockchains, Polkadot, Cardano, Algorand, do they have any chance?
Yeah, go ahead, Ryan.
Yeah, my take on this is kind of similar, right? So like David was saying earlier, in the bull run, everyone's looking for cheap block space, right? So we see this in every bull run. Everyone's like, oh, what's the next ETH killer? And last bull run, it was EOS, right? I'll start to believe it when I see blockchain revenue. Block space actually being sold. Again, what's the product of a blockchain? It's block space. Okay. So like if you're saying you're going to go compete against Apple and you've got a better mobile phone, show me your sales. Show me your Apple competitor iPhone sales, right? And if you look at the sales of block space and other chains, I mean, over the past 7 days, Ethereum block space sold 1,770x the block sales of Solana. Okay. And what's interesting here is Solana actually pays for economic security through issuance. It issues more of its token. Okay. And it issues at a rate right now, market cap of 5 to 6 billion per year. If you're looking at this through the lens of a nation state, right, that's a deficit. If you're looking at through the lens of a company, that's a cost. That's a loss.
Okay? Operating at a loss.
It's operating at a loss because its block space sold, you know, $300,000 or something like this, or $3 million, some order of scale. So it's like operating right now at a 99.4% loss. Okay, that's Solana. And Solana is not even the worst. Okay, Cardano has less blockchain sales. Avalanche has less blockchain sales. So they have full blocks, maybe, but no one's actually paying for them. So are they actually selling anything? No, they're not. So what would convince me otherwise with a Polkadot or a Cardano or a Solana is once I start to see blockchain sales revenue, sales volume. Without these things, quite frankly, these chains are not sustainable. They're sustainable during a bull run, though, because the bull run runs on narratives. It doesn't run on fundamentals. And the narrative right now is ETH doesn't scale. ETH is going to die. Like these other chains are better. Look at all of the adoption they're getting. And like people are just looking at in the wrong places and the wrong metrics, and they have these short-term time horizons. So I could definitely be convinced otherwise, but you have to convince me from the data. And if you look at blockchain sales, there's only two chains selling blocks right now. That's Bitcoin and Ethereum. The third category of chain selling blocks are layer twos. Okay? Like that's it. And Ethereum by far is dominant. So this could change in the future, keeping an open mind, but like these are the fundamentals that I look at. And I do, as David said, I do think decentralization is kind of the common denominator. Why are people still paying these outrageous gas fees on Ethereum? Decentralization, right? Like it's more valuable. And again, people make the mistake in thinking that users are going to continue to pay high gas fees on mainnet. They're not. Chains are going to be buying the block space of Ethereum in the future. Entire chains. These are roll-ups. So what is Cardano's and Solana's escape hatch? They become execution layers of Ethereum. They become roll-ups. I don't know if they'll ever do this. Not while their coins price is pumping. But this is, to me, the logical conclusion of what they probably should do and what makes the most sense to me.
Got it. Man, I hope these roll-ups and come fast, because I was trying to redeem my ENS airdrop and the gas fees alone were like, I don't know, a few hundred dollars or something. I'm like, I'm gonna wait a bit. Do you think in the next several months it'll come down at all?
On the L1, L1 gas fees are up only. So we are in this very weird time in crypto's history, Ethereum's history, where we are humans are actually on the layer one. The layer one is not meant for us. The layer one is meant for robots. It's meant for public transportation, not for individuals in cars. And so we will look back, like when we talk to our grandkids are like, oh, like, grandpa, you were on the layer one? That's crazy. How did you do that? Like, that's just not the long-term conclusion of where these systems go. If we want to scale out a global economy to the global world, we need many, many, many chains, many, many layer twos, and they will all settle on Ethereum, be coordinated by Ethereum. But the fact that we are on layer ones is just in this weird anomaly of Ethereum's history, where we are pre-adoption of layer twos, but post-adoption of Ethereum. We are just in that like uncanny valley right between those two things.
Mm-hmm. It's an awkward phase. It's puberty. And I think it's going to be painful. That probably, if there is a bull case for some of these ETH2 competitors and chains, it's right now. It's this moment in time while Ethereum is kind of transitioning, because there's going to be some pain involved in terms of like migrating users from layer one to layer two.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. David and Ryan, I want to thank you for an awesome discussion on Ethereum and the whole blockchain space. If I get another chance to speak with you, I definitely want to. I want to go deeper into this idea of this kind of parallel economy of Ethereum and the blockchain and what that means for economic opportunity for people. Does that change the game for, you know, possibilities for, you know, people to improve their lives for, let's say, the poor of the world, you know, the people who have been left out of traditional, you know, opportunities. What kind of potential does Ethereum have on a bigger scale than just personal profit? You know, how does this change the world in the bigger, like zooming out 100 years, 200 years? Like, does, you know, Ethereum really move the needle where we say, hey, this was one of the most important technological but also sociological? The other thing is, a lot of this stuff we're talking about, it's not just technological or economical. There's a lot of sociological and many different angles, like all combined. It's a multidisciplinary phenomenon that's going on. That's, I think, another reason why it's so fascinating. You know, it's not just a one-dimensional thing. I love the conversation with you guys. You brought out a lot of different angles and viewpoints. So for those who want to follow your work, I know you've got an awesome YouTube channel. You've broken 100,000 subscribers. My prediction, you guys are just going to go up dramatically in the future, just because you guys present great content. You know, you guys are objective, and you guys are great communicators, and you have a podcast that's awesome, and newsletter. Is there anywhere else where people can find you?
So yeah, the podcast on the RSS feed, the YouTube channel as well, and the newsletter on Substack. You can also follow us on Twitter. Might as well just follow Bankless HQ. If you follow that, you'll eventually see me and Ryan show up on that feed. We also have a DAO. Ryan and I, we are prolific content creators, but we are not CEOs. We are not interested in building out a massive company. But through our content, we have generated a lot of just interest in helping people, in people wanting to help promote the bankless revolution. And we do think that this is a revolution. And we didn't want to deprive people of that opportunity to help promote bankless just because Ryan and I are not the founder CEO types in the world. We just like our small studio. And so we made a DAO. And it's one of the biggest DAOs out there. It's extremely vibrant. And so if you believe in this bankless message and in the future of this self-sovereign economy, self-sovereign money, maybe the DAO is for you.
Awesome. And people can go on your website, I think it's bankless.hq.com, right, to find more info.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The newsletter is newsletter.bankless.hq.com.
Awesome. All right, I'll link to some of that info in the video description. Again, thanks again for the time. And we'll see you guys later.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks a lot, okay. Dave. Take care. See ya. Bye. Cheers.